Now, we're all interested today in the aspect of what's happening in the Middle East, and I believe it one of the most amazing things, and the thing we must understand more than anything else, and that is that Israel, the return of the land of Israel to the Jewish people and their return to the land, is a very pivotal axis in the understanding of Bible prophecy. The rebudding of the fig tree and the regathering of the Jewish people, the reestablishment of the nation of Israel, is the sign and the only sign given by Jesus in the 24th chapter of Matthew as to the last days. The reoccupation of Jerusalem by the Israelis, which happened in 1967, is the sign and the only sign that would mark the termination of the period of the time of Gentile domination of the world. So Jerusalem shall be trodden underfoot of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. This happened in 1967. After 25 centuries, Jerusalem had not been the Solar Rex capital of all Israel. And then in 1967, for the first time since the days of King Solomon, Jerusalem moved back as the capital of all the land of Israel. Not a divided nation. The two sticks had been joined, the dry bones had been revived, and Israel is back, and this is a very important thing as a pivotal axis of understanding Bible prophecy. Of course, there are those today who choose to pass this off as nothingness and who are really letting the vital things that the prophet spoke of go by with a twinge of an eye, because to admit the reestablishment of the Jewish state as a part of the fulfillment of Bible prophecy would indeed deny the very tenet of many Christian theologians that Christianity replaced Judaism. In the eyes of many Christians, the Jews have no more part. But in the Word of God, those who study the Bible and take the Bible in the plain, ordinary, normal, usual meaning of the words, certainly know that Israel must return and the Jewish people again must be established, and that the church did not do away with Israel, it did not replace Israel, and that the Jews are still God's chosen people and the church did not replace Israel. Of course, this is a theological concept that I really don't want to get into at this time, but to those who believe the Bible is literally true, and I use that word literal in the sense of the Hebrew text of the Scripture, those who take the words of the prophets literally must accept a reestablishment and a regathering of Israel, the Jewish people, in the last days. Now, in our study together of this portion in Isaiah chapter 19 that has to do with Egypt, I want to call your attention to the preceding chapter, because in the preceding chapter is a threshold to this chapter. We must read what goes before and what goes after. This is a basic rule of hermeneutics. To understand the entire context of a passage, to understand the syntax of a passage, to understand how it's used in the context where it's given. Now, the 19th chapter of Isaiah deals in great detail with the Egypt in the last days. Egypt in the last days that will sister Israel as a nation in the last days. And in the preceding chapter, in the 18th chapter, we find that the Lord promises the regathering of the Jewish people. In fact, many Bible commentators speak both of the 18th and the 19th chapter of Isaiah as being indicative of the last days, and I'm talking about scholars who lived before the return of the Jews, scholars who lived before the rise of modern Egypt. And these can be found in numerous commentaries where this passage is, by most Bible scholars, agree that it is futuristic and it has not been fulfilled before in history. But in the 18th chapter of Isaiah, he speaks of a regathering of a people that have been scattered. And in the context of that passage, it says, "Go ye," in verse 2, "go ye, swift messengers, to a nation scattered, and peal to a people terrible or suffering from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out, trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled. Now, this is talking about a literal nation that has been historically a nation of suffering. And, of course, who would that be, or who could that compare to other than the nation of Israel? And in the end of verse 2, he said, whose land the rivers have spoiled. In other words, in such a day that the whole land of Israel has been eroded and turned to a desert. And that's precisely what the land of Israel was at the turn of the 20th century. Then in verse 3, he said, all ye inhabitants of the world, and ye dwellers on the earth, see ye when he lifteth up an ensign on the mountains, and bloweth the trumpet, hear ye. Now here he's talking that in the last days there will be an ensign, a flag, a standard raised upon the mountains of Israel, and the peeled and trodden down people will be regathered. Here in verse 3, it's spoken that there will come a day when the flag of Israel will fly again over the mountains of Israel. You know, today, I remember back in 1967, I was in Israel, living there, studying in Hebrew University and at the yeshivas, and when the Six-Day War came, I had a very unusual experience in that. Many of you may be familiar, I was written up in Time magazine for having, in June 16th issue of 1967, as being the only American to fight with the Israeli forces. And I shall never forget that in our experience, in my experience, as I crossed from the old city to the, from the new city into the old city, I had to cross a minefield. And after I had crossed a minefield, I had to scale a wall, and when I went over the top of that wall, I was very near the Damascus Gate. Now, that wall no longer exists. It was a firewall that was taken down right after the 67 war. But I went over this firewall and down toward the Damascus Gate, and as I was going down by the wall, trying to avoid any places there could be mines, I looked up, and at the far end of the street, there was the Star of David flying on the Rockefeller Museum. I will never forget how gripped I was by that, because the Israeli flag, the sky was such a hue of blue that day, and the color of the blue in the flag, it looked, it caught my eye, because it looked as though the flag was transparent. It looked as though the blue in the flag blended so perfectly with the sky that all you could see was the white, and the blue blended in perfectly. And I stood there in amazement. It was like a miracle to see the sky so blue as it was that day. And that blue matched so perfectly the Star of David and the blue stripes on the Israeli flag. And it came to my mind the passage from Isaiah the prophet here in the 18th chapter, when he said, all ye inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, see ye when he lifteth up a flag or an ensign on the mountains and bloweth the trumpet, hear ye. It was not but very shortly after this that I was in the temple area. I had gone down through the streets of Jerusalem. There were still snipers going on and a few hand grenades being thrown, but I made my way down to the temple area, which was totally vacant. There was no one there. And as I was in the temple area, I went to the eastern gate, and then I came back up by the mosque when I heard a shofar, a ram's horn, being blown on the other side of the western wall. And here in this same passage, it talks about the flag, it talks about the shofar. Now, there's no way that I can begin to tell you the feelings, the experience that I had there in one day of seeing this very unusual, almost miraculous flag flying there as though it were transparent, the blue matching so perfectly with the blue sky, and then going directly to the temple area and hearing the shofar being blown on the other side of the temple. Later I learned that it was Rabbi Gorin, the chief rabbi of the Israeli army at that time, who's now the chief rabbi of Israel, who was blowing that shofar. But it was really an unusual experience that in one day I was privileged to see not only the ensign upon the mountains of Israel, but to hear the shofar, to hear the trumpet being blown on Mount Zion. So there's many things in Israel. As you live there, tourists go over and they come back never the same again. People I've had people to go with me on a trip that have been there many times, and they come back and they say, my, this is experiencing the whole Bible. It's like walking through the Bible. It's like living the Bible to be in the land of Israel. Well, if you can know that as a tourist, you should know the great joy of being there and living there as a citizen. It's 1,000 times more beautiful. I remember when they opened one of the gates of Jerusalem after the Six-Day War, by the Jaffa Gate. The Turks, 50 years before, had blocked that gate to keep General Allenby and the British Army out, keep them from breaking down the gates with tanks. And they were opening that gate that had been closed for 50 years. And as they were opening the gate, my Ulpan class was walking by. My language class was walking by from the Ulpan. And I said, wait just a minute. I said, if nobody's been through this gate for 50 years, let's wait and be the first ones through it, you know. So after the bulldozer had gotten the dirt out, we helped push the doors open. And we were the first ones, this class, were the first ones to step inside the gate, the Jaffa Gate, between 1917 and 1967. As we were standing there in the gate, and I looked through one direction and saw the old city, which had been for 19 years divided, and I looked back across the Hinnom Valley, or down the Hinnom Valley, toward the new city on the other side, in this no man's land that had formerly separated the new city from the old city, and we were standing inside this gate. The psalm came to my mind, and I turned over and found it and handed my Hebrew Bible to the Ulpan teacher and had her to read it, and she began to shout. You would think she was a Pentecostal. She became so jubilant, and she began to chant and to sing, "Behold, our feet stand in thy gates, O Jerusalem, a city rebuilt and reunited together." So there are just so many things that can happen in one's experience in the land of Israel today. It's so wonderful to come in to what God's doing in the world and to experience what's going on in the land of Israel. And I want to share with you today the 18th chapter of Isaiah just briefly as a springboard into the 19th chapter and what's being discussed about the revival of national Egypt, and especially since the people have been so aware since Camp David, Sadat, the assassination of Sadat and so forth, to really know what's going on in that theater. Now, in the last verse of the 19th chapter of Isaiah, or the 18th chapter of Isaiah, as he's discussing return of the Jews and so forth, and he's discussing the time, there's much metaphor here that has to do especially with the time of Israel's rebirth between the 4th and the 6th verses in a poetic language. But let's come to the conclusion, because we do want to spend as much time as possible today in the question of the 19th chapter and Egypt. But in the very last verse of the 18th chapter of Isaiah, he says, "In that time shall the present, the gift, be brought unto the Lord of hosts of a people scattered and peeled, and from a people terrible, suffering from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden underfoot, whose land the rivers have spoiled, to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, to Mount Zion." In other words, God's name is in this place. And while a lot of people today speak cynically of Zionism, Zion is the name of God who returns the people to Mount Zion. So the name of the Lord of hosts, Har Zion, Mount Zion, and Zionism today is a instrument by which God helped regather the Jewish people from the nations. I am a Christian Zionist. Anyone who believes that the Jews are God's chosen people, and anyone who believes that the land of Israel belongs to the Jewish people and they have a right to be there, anyone who prays for the peace of Jerusalem and who prays for the Jewish people, anyone who believes that their movement back in these last days to the land is a Zionist, regardless of his religious background. I know many Christians who are Zionists. I even know Arab Christians who are Zionists. Furthermore, I know Muslims who believe that the return of the Jews today is a fulfillment of the holy prophets, and they accept the return of the Jews as an act of God to the land. I'm talking about Muslim Arabs living in that country. So anyone who believes that is a Zionist to some degree. Whether and how consistent depends. But the idea of the return of the Jews to the land of Israel, the regathering of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, and the reestablishment of the nation of Israel is a Zionist. So here in Isaiah 18 and verses 1 through 7, we find a description of the regathering of the Jewish people, the giving again of the flag of Israel, the sound of the trumpet, and to see the Israel reestablished. Then, in that context, the very next verse, and you can forget the chapter division because it's chapter 19 is linked to chapter 18, because with the regathering of Israel and the rebirth of Israel, we see the rebirth of other ancient world empires. Out of the archaeological cemetery of time in the 20th century, we have seen the resurrection of nations that existed thousands of years ago. In Matthew, Jesus said, "Behold the learn the parable of the fig trees." Where in Mark he said, "Behold the fig tree and the other trees." The other trees are those trees who are symbolized around the nation of Israel. For example, if I say cedar, what country do you think of? The cedars of what? Lebanon. If I speak of the bramble or the thorn bush, what do you think of? The bramble of Syria. If we speak of the reed and the smoking flax, what do you think of? Egypt. You see, these ancient empires had in them symbols of their antiquity, and in the vernacular of the prophets, they many times used the symbols from the plant or animal kingdom to symbolize those nations. In the Jewish Haggadah, it talks about the cat that bit the kid. In the Passover, at the end of the Passover, there's a song called the Haggadah. And in the Haggadah, it's one lamb that father bought for two zuzims, one lamb, one lamb. Then came the cat and bit the lamb or the kid that father bought for two zuzims, Haggadah, Haggadah. Then came the dog and bit the cat that ate the kid that bit the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah. Then came the stick and hit the dog that bit the cat that ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah. Then came the fire and burned the stick and hit the dog that bit the cat that ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah. Then came the fire and burned the stick and hit the dog that bit the cat that ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah. Then came the water and quenched the fire that burned the stick, hit the dog, bit the cat, ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah, one lamb, one lamb. Then came an ox and drank the water that quenched the fire that burned the stick, hit the dog, bit the cat, ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah. Then came the slaughterer and slaughtered the ox that drank the water that quenched the fire that burned the stick, that hit the dog, that bit the cat, that ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah. Then came the angel of death and slaughtered the slaughterer that slaughtered the ox that drank the water that quenched the fire that burned the stick that hit the dog that bit the kid that ate ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah. Then came the Holy One, blessed is he, and slew the angel of death that slew to the slaughter that slaughtered the ox that drank the water that quenched the fire that burned the stick that hit the dog that bit the cat that ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. Haggadah, Haggadah. Now to the average person, this is simply a childish lilt. However, there is an interpretation of this that symbolizes Egypt as the cat that bit Israel, the kid, and Assyria, the dog, the cat was a deity of Egypt, and the dog was a symbol of Assyria that bit the cat that ate the kid that father bought for two zuzims. And then came the stick of Babylon and struck the Assyrian that bit the dog of Assyria that bit the cat of Egypt that ate the kid of Israel. And then came the water of Greece and smote the Babylon, the fire of Persia and the water of Greece and the ox of Rome and the slaughterer of Germany, the Ashkenazic slaughter of Hitler, and then so forth. In other words, in the Haggadah, each of these animals have a symbolic meaning. But we must apply hermeneutical laws when we're taking these symbols. And I'm using this just to illustrate the reed of Egypt and the fig tree of Israel and the olive tree of Israel's temple worship and spiritual economy and the cedars of Lebanon and all those symbols that are symbolic, but the symbolism is absolute. You just can't take them and apply them anywhere. Now then, let's look just a moment at the 19th chapter. And let's look at the first three verses. The burden of Egypt. Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud. He shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians shall melt in the midst of it. I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight every one against his brother, every one against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. And the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof, and I will destroy the counsel thereof, and they shall seek to idols and to charmers and to them that have familiar spirits and to wizards. Now, in the first three verses of this chapter, we see Egypt under a monarchy which is an anarchy. In the first three verses, it describes a revolution and a rebellion in Egypt under a monarchy that is so bad that anarchy rules and overthrows the monarchy. Now, the question that we ask today, has there been a time in ancient history or in modern history when such a thing has happened? In modern Egyptian history, was there a period of time when under a monarchy, anarchy overthrew the monarchy? Or a revolution overthrew the king? And of course, the answer is very obvious for those who know modern Egyptian history. Yes. We remember that there was, after the establishment of the nation of Israel, of Egypt, by the British, that King Farouk was the king of Egypt. And King Farouk oppressed the Egyptian people, first of all, by declaring all the land of Egypt state land, and then all the chattel of Egypt state property, which simply meant that every person was living, even though he may have bought a house and built a house, the house was property of the king, and the people who built it and thought they owned it were only vassals of the king. And in this condition of oppression, the Egyptian people had a revolution which just sprang up in every quarter. It was not a single coup, but it was there began to be the people of southern Egypt begin to rebel against northern Egypt. And then we find that one city would be fighting against the other city. And the army of Farouk was divided. There was coups within the military. There was all types of treachery. And Egypt boiled into a seething pot after the war of 1948. So by 1952, the revolution came to the point that Farouk went into exile, and coming out of that revolution, President Nasser became the president of Egypt. Now then, let's look at these verses, and I've made a present application to these verses. But we always have to be honest and ask ourselves, well, yes, this is precisely and exactly what happened in these days. However, to be honest with ourselves, this is not the first time that such a thing has happened in Egypt. There have been several periods before, when the one line of the pharaohs was overthrown and the land of Egypt was desolate for 40 years, and those pharaohs or those families, ruling families that were driven out of Egypt, the prophet said they would never return, but they would wander among the nations forever. And even though Israel would be scattered among all nations, God said, I will regather them But these Egyptians that are scattered will never return, but they will be vagabonds and they will be wanderers among all the nations forever, and they will never be returned to the land of Egypt. Of course, you say, well, has that been fulfilled? Well, certainly it has been fulfilled, and it's being fulfilled today. Do you know that what we call the gypsies that wander all over Europe and Africa, in the Orient, and even here in America, the wandering gypsy, the gypsies are those families that were driven out of Egypt, and after that, the desolation of Egypt for 40 years, and those Egyptians or those gypsies are still in their caravans wandering over the world, and even the gypsies today are a fulfillment of the prophetic word that they will wander among the nations and never be regathered. Now that doesn't mean that all the Egyptians, but that particular period and dynasty of Egyptians are still wandering over the world today, and they are known as the gypsies. So we see that the word of God was fulfilled historically. It has been being fulfilled in the lives of these gypsies. It is being fulfilled today, and it shall be fulfilled in the future. Israel, which was scattered among the nations, however, would be regathered and brought back to the land of Israel. Here in the drama of this first three verses, we have to recognize that there have been several times when monarchy was overthrown by anarchy in the land of Egypt. So this chapter, while we can say, yes, this has happened today, we must, in all honesty, say, yet this very same thing has happened before. But there is one particular difference, and that is that the preceding verse and the preceding chapter deals with the regathering of the children of Israel out of all nations, and their return to the land of Israel. Therefore, we find that in the final analysis, that if we take the seventh verse of chapter 18 as a connective to the first chapter of verse 19, then it would frame us into modern history. But as far as these three verses go, they have to be interpreted in the context to know when they happen. Therefore, we cannot to properly interpret this first three verses. These verses could not be fulfilled until what was said before about the regathering of Israel would be evident. And it must also coincide with what happens after verse 3. What is the description of what happens, for example, in the 4th through the 17th verses of the chapter? Now, this is very important. If what happened in verse 1, 2, and 3 was relative to the period of King Farouk of Egypt, who was overthrown in 1952, then all those things that would happen subsequent to that should also be parallel to what would happen historically in Egypt after that time. So this is the real acid test to see whether or not verses 1 through 3 is talking about King Farouk, and whether the following verses will deal with Israel and Egypt today and in the future, in the immediate future of that country. Now then, in order to see let's take a look at the fourth verse and see what is described in those following verses with regard to the successor of King Farouk. Notice in verse 4 he says, "And the Egyptians will I give over to the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith the Lord of hosts, the Lord of hosts." Now, certainly, I think anyone who knows the history of Egypt in modern times can see that if there were ever two people that had a similar character and personality, it would be Fidel Castro and Nasser. Both of these rose out of the army with the military coup and became a harsh ruler and an oppressor of many of the people. Now, when Nasser came to power, there was a great exodus of Egyptians that left for other nations because they could foresee the character and nature of this ruler. And from 1952 and the following 20 years of his reign, Egypt, many things happened in Egypt dramatically. Now let's see what it says here. First of all, this cruel lord and fierce king, who I believe was Nasser, considered himself the spokesman and the chief monarch of all the Arab peoples, even though Egypt is not an Arab nation. It belongs to the African bloc of nations. While it is Islamic, ethnically, Egypt, Kush, Mitzrayim, Lud, which is Egypt, Ethiopia, and Libya, belong to the African bloc of nations. The true Egyptian is Hamitic, not Semitic. But here, this great Egyptian king thought himself to be a spokesman for the entire Arab world. So he established the United Arab Republic, the UAR, which no longer exists, and proclaimed himself the monarch of all Arab peoples. Of course, the Syrians and the Jordanians and the other Arab nations gave tongue-in-cheek submission to Nasser because they wanted his power. He was the major power, military power, and they needed Egypt and this alliance in order to destroy Israel. Nasser's dream of being the monarch of the entire Fertile Crescent and being the president or the king of the United Arab Republic never came to a reality. And Nasser always explained that failure. He said that Israel is a saber in my side, because the land of Israel, the Negev, came down just like a knife and separated Egypt from the other Arab countries. So you can see why Nasser was so determined to destroy the nation of Israel. After he was a commander in the army of 1948, in 1952 the coup, in 1956 the Sinai campaign, where Nasser, armed with the Russians, was going to try to destroy Israel, which was the perhaps one of the biggest jokes in history, at least until the 67 war. And then in 1967 again, Nasser declared war on Israel and their destruction. And we find that he was he had to get the saber out of his side, and he never was successful. I never will forget the humor of one of the congressmen or one of the senators during right after the Six-Day War, when they said, or right before the Six-Day War, when they made a statement, "What is Nasser going to do with Israel?" And you know, the real question was not what Nasser was going to do with Israel. The real question was, what was Israel going to do with Nasser? Because to the world's dismay, the mighty armies of Egypt were not to be compared with just a few brigades of the Israeli army in the Sinai. But let's see how it describes this cruel lord and this fierce king. Let's see what happens during his reign. Now in the following verses, in verses 5 down through verses 11, it says that this king is going to bring about a dramatic change in the hydrology of Egypt. That is, that he is going to alter the water sources of Egypt, and it's going to bring a very great catastrophe on the land of Egypt. Now, the thing that we notice, if you notice in verse 5, it says, "The waters shall fail from the sea, and the rivers shall be wasted and dried up." Now, to understand the hydrology of Egypt, when the floodwaters of the Nile come down in the spring, the Mediterranean breezes and the waves are coming from the north, and it backs up the Nile. The tides that come in back the Nile up and force it to flood the entire delta area. And with this flooding of the Nile waters that is brought about by the Mediterranean tides coming in and pushing the Nile's waters back, this was very important. But it took a very good volume of water coming down the Nile River to bring about this natural irrigation system of the Nile for the Delta region. Here he says, the waters shall fail from the sea, and the rivers shall be wasted and dried up. How will this happen? In verse 6 says, and they will turn the rivers far away, and the brooks of defense shall be emptied and dried up, and the reeds and the flags shall wither. Now, was there anything that happened in the reign of King Nasser, or President Nasser in Egypt, that caused the drying up of the Nile River? Certainly there was. And what was it? But the building of the Aswan Dam. First of all, a lot of people do not realize it, but the building of the Aswan Dam was a vision of the American Corps of Engineers. However, there were several things they did not take into account. The Americans first proposed the building of the dam and the financing of the dam to woo Egypt into the American fold. But a professor, an Israeli professor in the University of Tel Aviv, issued a paper, and it was presented to the U.S. State Department, showing the catastrophe that would happen to the ecology of Egypt if this dam were built. And, of course, the State Department took this into consideration and reconsidered and changed their mind about building the dam because of the ecological factors that would result. The professor pointed out that since it was the particular type of sand that was under there would create a continuous percolation of the water, and it would be impossible to keep the dam full. If the dam were filled during flood season, they could not hold the water because of the percolation of the soil. The waters would keep penetrating under the dam and flowing underground. Then if the dam was ever built, because there is no stability of the soil, the volume of water in the flood season would be so great that it would cause the dam to crack, and that it could break, and the entire population of Egypt, which lives right along the Nile River, could be flushed into the sea. Isn't it strange that an Israeli would try to keep that from happening at that particular time? But he did. And of course, we know that all the things that he said happened. The land, you must be very careful when you begin to change the natural courses of rivers or try to dredge or so forth. The ecological result can be totally disastrous. But in these verses, in verses 5 down through the 11th verse, or 10th verse, we find that the result of cutting off the waters of the river would be devastating both on the ecology and on the economy of the Egyptians, because the reeds and the flags shall wither. Of course, Egypt had always been known for its papyri and for its reeds, in making the ancient papyri that was used for paper. But as a result of the building of the Aswan Dam, the only papyri that is left in Egypt today is that that is cultivated in the Papyri Institute in Cairo, because everything else was lost as a result of this dam. It says the paper reeds, that is the papyri reeds, by the brook, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything that is sown by the brook shall wither, be driven away, and be no more. In verse 8 and in verse 10, let's take verse 9 first, and then we'll come back to that. It says, moreover, they that work in flax, that is, those that weave the needleworks of linen, shall be confounded. So there is a complete upset in the economy. Egyptian flax used to be exported all over the world, and it was world famous for flax. But because of what happened with the building of the dam, today Egypt is primarily a producer of cotton and not of linen. In verse 8 and verse 10 says, the fishers also shall mourn, and they that cast the angle into the brook shall lament, and they that spread their net upon the waters shall languish. In verse 10, and they shall be broken in the purpose thereof, all that make sluices and ponds for fish. So we find that due to the building of this dam, because this fierce king did this, that the nation of Israel, the nation of Egypt, would go into an agricultural crisis, it would go into an economic crisis, and it would go into an industrial crisis because of the building of this dam, precisely like the prophet of Tel Aviv had predicted in his paper given to the State Department that caused the U.S. to cease to support the dam. And of course, the Russians stepped in and took advantage of that opportunity, and the Russians built the dam that has been such a catastrophe to Egypt. And for this purpose and for this reason, President Sadat aborted all the agreements with Egypt because of the ill that had been caused by the Russians in indirect way against America, and the Egyptian had been made to suffer for being used as a pawn on the international chessboard by Russia against the U.S. So we see that Sadat later made a complete change in this attitude. But in the latter years of Nasser's reign can be very well depicted in verses 10 through verses 17. We're going to see some very amazing things that happen. And they, in verse 11 it says, "Surely the princes of Zoan are fools, and the council of the wise counselors of Pharaoh are become brutish. How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, and a son of the ancient kings? Where are they? Where are the wise men? Let them tell thee now, let them know that the Lord of hosts has purposed upon Egypt. The princes of Zoan are become fools. The princes of Noph are deceived. They have also seduced Egypt, even they that are in the stay of the tribes thereof. The Lord hath mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof. They have caused Egypt to err, and every work thereof is as a drunken man staggering or wallowing in his vomit. Neither shall there be any work of Egypt which is the head, or the tail, or the brush, or the rush may do. In that day Egypt shall be like a woman, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which shaketh over it." Now in these verses it describes pretty well the characteristic of the reign of King, of President Nasser. And Nasser reigned as a fierce king with an iron fist, and people feared. And that kind of fear did not create respect. And that kind of fear did not create an energy in the people of Egypt to be productive. And they were always found to be the object of ill circumstance. And it was like an ill omen was over everything they did. And finally the Egyptian came to see that it was the hand of the Lord that was against the land of Egypt. And why was the hand of the Lord against the land of Egypt? Because their next door neighbor to the north, the Israelis, were prospering, and Israel was blooming, and Israel was exporting foods all over the world, even exporting food to Egypt so that the Egyptian would not starve. And here we find such a dramatic thing that in that attitude. Now the key verse to this whole time question is found in verse 17. In verse 17, "And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt, and every one that maketh mention thereof shall be afraid in himself because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts which hath determined against it. The land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt." Now, when in ancient history were the Egyptians ever afraid of the Israelis? To the contrary, it was always the Israelis that feared the Egyptians. And it was always the Israelis that were trying to make a league with Egypt, because they wanted Egypt's support against an invasion of the north from Assyria or from Babylon. It was never the Egyptian that feared the Israeli, it was the Israeli that feared the Egyptian. So time-wise and a time marker can be set down in verse 17 that today is the first time in the history of Egypt and Israel that the Egyptian has been afraid of the Israeli. In these days, since the turn of this century, have we seen the overthrow of the monarchy of Farouk by a revolution succeeded by a fierce king with a cruel lord. With an iron fist to rule over his land. A king that would change the water courses of the Nile River and bring the land to economic and political chaos. Here, the Egyptian is afraid of the Israeli. Yes, after 1948, 1956, 1967, and 1973, the Egyptian had a right to fear the Israeli. And I have seen this illustrated so much in Egypt, especially since the Israelis are going to visit Egypt today. You see nothing but adoration and almost servitude on the part of the Egyptian in their attitude toward an Israeli. Now, in verse 17, I think there's a turning point here. Because in verse 18 it says, in that day five cities in the land of Egypt shall speak the language of Canaan and swear to the Lord of hosts, and one shall be called the city of destruction. Now right here we come to a verse that has not been fulfilled. We come to a verse that does not fit with the rest. Now wait a minute. What does this mean? It means perhaps that in time we have come down to the point that between 17 and 18 something happens here. How would five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan? The language of Canaan is today, the land of Canaan is today called the land of Israel, and the language of Israel today is the Hebrew language. Now how would five cities in the land of Egypt be speaking the Hebrew language? Today, there is a big controversy. Since this is the beginning of 1982, we're seeing a great controversy in Israel about the cities between El Arish and Gaza that have been built, the settlements that have been built since 1967. In the building of these Jewish settlements along there, there's a big controversy today. And those people on those settlements said they are not going to move. The Israeli government has, since the peace agreement that they will withdraw, the Israeli government has offered fantastic amounts of money to those settlers to move. Now, I think what we may see happen, and very possibly happen, is that these cities that have been established in this area, one of those cities is going to be destroyed. But I think as a result of that destruction, the Hablanut, of that city, that it's going to bring a revolution in Israel itself, and it's going to become a very delicate issue. And that those Israelis who are very unhappy about having gone down and poured 12 or 14 years of their lives into the desert to make it bloom, don't want to give it back to Egypt. But Israel has agreed to give it back to Egypt in the peace agreement. Now, there could be a compromise, and at the same time, not only a compromise, but a prototype. You see, the Palestinian question, Begin refused to let be brought into the peace agreement with Egypt. There was no stipulation in the Egypt-Israel peace about what would happen to the Palestinians. Sadat knew that. Completely boycotted the meetings. Carter put all kind of pressure on Begin. But Begin, as stubborn as he is, thank God, did not concede to Sadat and Carter. And insisted that the West Bank, the Palestinians, is another question. They have to recognize Israel. They'll have to make peace with Israel directly and not through a third party. Of course, the Palestinians
are never going to do that. Carter knew that, Sadat knew that, and Begin knew that. So, new, so what? They don't want to recognize Israel? So what difference does it make? Here, we see a formula. Suppose that those five cities, when Egypt is given back in a few months, will be given back all that territory. Let's suppose that those five cities in the Sinai, between Gaza and El Arish, that those cities will remain occupied by Israelis, and that those Israelis will be not citizens of Egypt, but rather remain citizens of Israel, precisely as the Palestinians in the West Bank will reside in Israel, but will have their allegiance to Jordan. The Israelis in the Egypt, that is where they have their settlements, could have their own police force for their own protection, just like the Palestinians in the West Bank have their own police courts, and yet being citizens of Jordan. So what we have in the Sinai could be a prototype and a working model for the arrangement in the West Bank, so that it would be an even balance. And in that case, I would expect that even more Israelis would live in that area, and that whole west side would be of Egypt would be developed. Certainly, the Egyptians have never used that territory. It's only been a springboard for an attack against Israel. It is a desert that only the Jews could make to bloom, and it would be an advantage to the Egyptian to have that area productive for produce to be shipped both to Israel and Egypt. In other words, Egypt needs food, and the Israelis could produce that food on their western border and still be aliens in Egypt and citizens of Israel speaking the Hebrew language in the land of Egypt, exactly as it is described in the 18th verse of Isaiah chapter 19. And thought of the Egyptian peace, there was something that happened in the peace process of Camp David that was related to me by a very close friend, David Horowitz. In 1977, President Sadat shocked the world when he announced that he was ready to go to Jerusalem and discuss peace. Unfortunately, the world does not know what went on behind those scenes. There were other people working, and we're going to discuss with you what went on behind the scenes with regard to verses 19 through 25 of the 19th chapter of Isaiah. Now, David Horowitz, who is United Nations correspondent for Jewish presses in New York City, related to me something that happened at Camp David that has sort of been left out of the books and the reports. You remember at Camp David there was a deadlock, and there was no way that they could come to agreement. President Carter and President Sadat were trying to put pressure on Prime Minister Begin to force him to bring the Palestinian question into the Camp David agreements. To this, Begin would not agree. First of all, Egypt has no authority to speak for the Palestinians when the Palestinians refuse to recognize or meet with Israel. Secondly, if the peace was based on the Palestinians, if the Palestinians broke that agreement, it would jeopardize the peace between Israel and Egypt. The Israeli and Egyptian peace, insisted Begin, must stand on the merit of Egypt and Israel. While the U.S. is a mediator, it must be a peace not via the U.S., but it must be a peace between Egypt and Israel, between Sadat and between Begin, between Israel and Egypt, and not include the Palestinian or anything else. Later, President Carter said that President Sadat was the greatest gentleman he had ever met and the easiest man to work with, but Menachem Begin was the most stubborn man that he had ever met. Well, coming from Carter, I think that Mr. Begin considered that a compliment. Nevertheless, we see that in the drama of the Camp David agreements, and we're going to come back and see why Camp David happened a little later, but in the drama of the Camp David agreement, while they were meeting, Sadat got to the place that he would not even come out of his room. He would not meet with Begin or Carter. He just isolated himself and would not go into it. Carter was blaming Begin for being stupid, or being stubborn. Who was it that had barricaded themselves in the room, Begin or Sadat? Isn't this ironic that Carter is blaming Begin for being stubborn when Sadat won't come out of his room? Now, if you can put that together with any rationale. But after some time, and days and days and days wore on, and the three great world leaders were there, and nothing was happening. There was a news blockout. No news. Everything at Camp David had come to a standstill. And the world began to believe that nothing would really come of the hope of peace in the Middle East. And, of course, if it had not, who would have been blamed, Sadat or Begin? It would have been Begin. But Begin was willing to risk that chance. Finally, one night, Prime Minister Begin went to the room of President Carter. He took with him a Bible, and he sat down, and with the Bible, he reasoned with Mr. Carter. Now, doesn't this sound strange? The Prime Minister of Israel dealing with Carter, a born-again Christian, out of a Bible, trying to get the Christian to agree with the Word of God. But in this discussion, David Horowitz pointed out that Prime Minister Begin showed President Carter in the 19th chapter of Isaiah, where the prophet Isaiah predicted a peace between Israel and Egypt. A peace between Israel and Egypt. And out of that discussion, President Carter made perhaps the greatest decision of his life. He made the most valid statement he ever made when he told Prime Minister Begin that if Mr. Sadat will go along with this, I will too. Now, Mr. Begin then went to Mr. Sadat. It was not a meeting. It was a personal call. And he went into President Sadat. And he sat down, this time with the Bible in Arabic. You see, the Muslims also believe in the Old Testament, and probably more in the New Testament than most Christians realize. And here we find that Menachem Begin sits with Sadat, and he opens the Bible to Isaiah chapter 19. He also takes a copy of Josephus and describes how that Alexander the Great came against Jerusalem, and when he came to Jerusalem, the priest opened the city to him, and he was welcomed with honor, and there was not a war. And how that a certain priest showed Alexander the Great in the writings of Daniel that Daniel had spoke of the great king of Greece who would come and who would conquer the world and who would make a peace with Israel. And Alexander the Great, seeing that the scripture had spoken of him, rejoiced greatly and offered sacrifices to the God of Israel. He pointed out also that King Cyrus, king of Persia, was mentioned in the book of Isaiah before he was born. And how that here Daniel spoke of Alexander the Great, and how that Isaiah had spoken of Cyrus. And then he turned and said, is it possible that the one that is spoken of here in this chapter is you? Listen to these words. In verse 19, when Menachem Begin shared this with Sadat, Sadat came out, they both came out laughing and rejoicing, and the next day they had a meeting, a news conference, and the success of the peace of Camp David was materialized. It was materialized because of Isaiah the prophet. The news, the media, never has printed that here in the 19th chapter. You remember when President Sadat came out. Maybe you remember seeing it on television. as Begin and Sadat and Carter were walking arm in arm, and when President Sadat made his statement, he said, after this peace is finished, and after we will have a peace where we will never again have war with Israel, after this agreement has been fulfilled, I have two missions left in this life. One is to build in Cairo a shrine to the three great religions of the world, to Judaism, Christianity, and the Islam. And he described this shrine that he wanted to build like a pyramid that would have one point toward Mecca, another point toward Jerusalem, and another point toward the Western world, symbolizing the directions of the Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. And how that the one God would be honored, the God of the Jews, the God of the Islam, and the God of the Christian is one God, said President Sadat. Why should we be divided? So those of you who remember the pictures of the assassination of President Sadat, in the background could be seen that triangular pyramid that was built to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and will soon be open for visitors to go and to visit this great monument that was built in commemoration of three great religions. And then secondly, said Sadat, I want to build on Mount Sinai, on the border between Israel and Egypt, a memorial to this peace agreement. And I want to honor in that President Carter and President and Prime Minister Begin and myself will be there, named on the monument to always remind us that Israel and Egypt shall never again be at war. Now, do you realize why President Sadat made that statement? Because the night before in his room, Menachem Begin had shared with him the 19th verse of the 19th chapter of the book of Isaiah. In that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they shall cry unto the Lord because of their oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior, a great one, and he shall deliver them. Anwar Sadat was recognized in Time magazine as the man of the year in 1977 for his valiant, courageous stand to completely turn his nation, who had been for decades an enemy of Israel, to be an ally of Israel. Here, this great Savior, and the Hebrew word there for Savior is Moshiach, which is the same word for Mashiach, meaning Messiah. I will send my anointed one, even a great one, and he shall deliver them. The world looks back in memory to President Sadat as being perhaps the most courageous politician and statesman in the history of the world. Anwar Sadat did what no other ruler has ever done. He made peace with Israel, which was to the contrary of all the history of his modern nation, and which meant that would bring the wrath of all his allies of the past, and which would eventually bring his own death. And I think that Anwar Sadat was conscious of that death when he said, after this peace, only two objectives I have in this life. To build a shrine in Cairo to the one God of Christianity, of Judaism, and the Islam. and to build a pillar, a memorial on the border to this peace agreement. He spoke words as though there was a voice in him saying that he would be sacrificed as a Messiah. You know, the tragedy is about Messiahs, about great deliverers, about great emancipators, is that usually they die because of their efforts. Martin Luther King stood in that great auditorium the night before he was assassinated. With tears streaming down his cheeks, he said, "I stand on the mountain. I see the good land, but I can't enter it." Like Moses of old, Martin Luther King had some internal knowledge that he was going to be sacrificed for the cause for which he had lived would be the cause for which he died. Abraham Lincoln made the Emancipation Proclamation as almost a deliverer, a Messiah to the slaves. But the cause for which he lived, he died. Anwar Sadat, in this verse, it says, I will send them a Savior, Moshiach, one who will be sacrificed. And the next verse says, and the Lord shall be known to the Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know the Lord Jehovah in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation, yea, they shall vow a vow unto the Lord and shall perform it. Immediately after the assassination of President Sadat, the new president, Hosni Mubarak, said, Egypt will perform all its signed agreements with Israel, which included the entire peace process. At this point, I want to do some speculation. And I want you to know that it is speculation. I have tried to learn, but I cannot find out for sure exactly what brought about the decision of President Nasser in 1977 to so boldly jump up and say, I'm ready to go to Israel and talk peace. Certainly there had to be some background behind it. In what research I have been able to do, and understand, I am giving an interpretation of events as I can understand them, and I do not know for sure. Please understand me. I am not being dogmatic. I'm trying to find an answer. Why did Sadat make this decision? Several years ago, I read a book by Ezra Weitzman, the nephew of Chaim Weitzman, the man who was the first president of Israel and the one that brought about the Balfour Declaration. The name of this book by Ezra Weitzman was called On Eagle's Wings, and it was a story of the Israeli Air Force. He has since written another book. And this book is The Road to Peace, which describes the peace negotiations. Now, out of the last book, I could not get the answer of what I assumed to be in the first book, and perhaps for a reason. Please understand me again. I'm trying to put the pieces together. You want to join me? If you will get a copy of Ezra Weitzman's book On Eagle's Wings, The Story of the Israeli Air Force, he tells about being stationed in England. Ezra Weitzman was in the RAF before the establishment of the State of Israel, and then he went to England for special aviation training after the establishment of the State of Israel, about 1949-1950. And in his class in England, in the RAF school, were two Egyptians. Now you can imagine, here's an Israeli in a class with two Egyptians, which had just been walloped by the Israelis in the War of 1948, Israel's Independence War. And the feelings were very icy, and you could feel the tensions between the two Egyptians and the Israeli. But as time went on, the Israeli, and anybody that knows Ezra Weitzman knows his very casual, non-pretentious attitude, Salam Aleichem, and he began to speak, and before long, if nobody was around, they would, you know, stand and talk with each other. Weitzman, who could speak Arabic also, was some help, but in time, they broke the ice, and the hostility and the icy feelings between Ezra Weitzman, the Israeli, and his friend, one of his friends, whose name was Jimmy Afifi, or Jimael Afifi, that is the name that Weitzman uses in the book. According to Ezra Weitzman, Jimmy Afifi was the commander of Elah Resh in the 1948 war with Israel, while at the same time, Ezra Weitzman himself was a pilot and officer under Dan Tolkovsky in the Israeli Air Force. During their time in England, in the RAF school, Ezra Weitzman relates a story of how on one evening he invited Jimmy Afifi and several other officers to join him in the officers' club for a drink to a special occasion that evening. When they came to the officers' club, they poured the drinks, and Ezra Weitzman lifted the drink to the officers, to which Jimmy Afifi says, "And to what is the occasion of the drink?" And Ezra Weitzman said, "This is the second anniversary of the State of Israel. We drink to the rebirth of my nation." And at this, Jimmy Afifi was stunned, but he got the drink down and turned and walked off. Later, Afifi told some of the officers about the chutzpah, or the audacity, of this Israeli inviting him to drink to the rebirth of the war, of a nation which was his enemy. A few weeks later, Jimmy Afifi invites Weitzman to join him in a drink at the officers' club. Weitzman responded, went to the officers' club, and with several other officers, Jimmy Afifi lifted his glass, and Weitzman asked, "And Jimmy, to what is the occasion of this drink?" And his response was, "To the birth of the new king of Egypt. Farouk, my king, has just had a son. To the prince we make this drink." To this, Ezra Weitzman lifted his glass and said, "Long live the king." And it turned out to be more than just a drink. According to Weitzman, on the way home that night, they had to almost help each other to their rooms. And as Ezra Weitzman left Afifi, he said, "Jimmy, I hope we never meet at 20,000 feet." "Oh, we won't," said Jimmy, "because Israel, there will not be another war because Israel will collapse economically." After this, we find that Jimmy Afifi once invited Ezra Weitzman to his home. Weitzman was just a little bit of skeptical about going, and his wife encouraged him to go ahead, so they went to the home of Jimmy Afifi to be a guest for dinner. And who was there? Who was there other than the head of the Egyptian intelligence? This even made Weitzman more nervous, but as the night went on, they relaxed, and he saw that there was really no ulterior motive, that he really felt that Jimmy had invited he and his wife there for a good social evening. A few weeks later, Ezra Weitzman invites Jimmy Afifi to come to their home. And they had a special guest that night also. It was a one-eyed general from Israel, Moshe Dayan. But it was a beautiful atmosphere, and as time grew on, you saw a friendship begin to grow. You'll probably notice in this story that Weitzman relates that there's sort of we've heard of the war of attrition. We might call this the war of ethics, as one was trying to outbid the other in generosity and kindness. But even in this, one can see almost a combat between the Egyptian and the Israeli, even in their hospitality. But as time went on, Ezra Weitzman related that slowly it became a very close and a very warm friendship between the Egyptian and the Israeli. And in time,
as it became a very frequent thing for them to visit each other's home, the son of Ezra Weitzman, the young child, little boy in his house, by the name of Shaul, became very closely attached to Jimmy Apifi. And as the relationship grew, it really became a close friendship. In December of 1950, there was a break in diplomatic relationships between Great Britain and Egypt. So Jimmy Apifi left England and returned to Egypt and entered the Egyptian Air Command. And his book, Ezra Weitzman, relates how that as he went up in the Israeli Air Force, that Jimmy Apifi ascended through the up the ladder in the ranks of the Egyptian Air Force. So there's sort of a parallel between these two men, not only in friendship and in neighbors as countries, but in their ascent up the ladder to success in each respective branch of service. In Weitzman's description of Jimmy Apifi, after he left the school in December of 1950, he returned to Egypt, was in the Egyptian Air Command, and in 1957, at that time particularly, he points out that Jimmy Apifi was an instructor at the school of the Egyptian Air Command in Cairo. That's on page 116 in his book. In 1957, we find that he was promoted and became the head of the became the head of the Egyptian Air Command School. And in 1966, he became the Air Marshal of the Egyptian Air Force. So as Apifi continues to go up in the Egyptian Air Force, Ezra Weitzman is going up the ranks almost parallel in the Israeli Air Force. And in 1967, while Ezra Weitzman was a commander of the Egyptian of the Israeli Air Force in 1967 Six-Day War, Jimmy Apifi was a deputy commander of the Egyptian Air Command in Cairo. Very funny story is told about after the war was over that Ezra Weitzman actually sent an apology to Apifi about destroying the Air Force on the ground, because he said, I knew if your Air Force got in the air, we wouldn't have a chance. So the dignity of Apifi was salvaged out of the kindness of Ezra Weitzman. Now, this book, published in 1976, did not mention some other things that happened in the process of the relationship between Egypt and Israel. In 1975, the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, which is noted, recognized by most people as the best in the world, the Israeli intelligence, the Mossad, informed Ezra Weitzman that there was an attempt for the assassination of President Sadat by a group of the PLO under Nasser Arafat. So it is related that Ezra Weitzman made a telephone call to Europe, connected with the call back to Egypt, since he could not call directly to Egypt from Israel, and asked his friend, whoever the friend was in Egypt, to meet him at a given destination. So Weitzman flew to that destination, met with his friend from Egypt, and gave him the portfolio on the planned assassination of Sadat by the PLO. His friend returned to Egypt in 1975, turned this over to Sadat. The Egyptian intelligence took charge of it, found that it was really true, and aborted the assassination attempt on Sadat by the Palestinian Liberation Organization. In 1977, the Mossad again handed Ezra Weitzman a report that there was an attempted assassination on the life of Sadat by Gaddafi of Libya. Again, Ezra Weitzman called Europe, connected to Egypt, got a hold of his friend, who met him again, and he again handed him the report of the Mossad of the assassination of Sadat by Gaddafi. He returned in 1977 and delivered this to Sadat again. It was verified that it was true. Now, what is amazing is that the same week that this report was given to Sadat, in November 1977, President Sadat announced that he was prepared to go to Israel to discuss peace. So out of that meeting, and what I'm trying to point out today is that whoever this friend of Ezra Weitzman was holds a very, very strong position in the negotiations between Egypt and Israel. And I think that what we see here is that Ezra Weitzman in Israel and his friend Jimmy Afifi in Egypt held a key. But it seemed that Jimmy Afifi at this time fades out of the picture altogether. We don't find any other mention of Jimmy Afifi. I was interested to know, after the assassination of Sadat on October of 1981, I contacted the embassy of Egypt, the Egyptian consulate and embassy in Washington. They put me in contact with the Egyptian military attaché, because I was able to secure from the consulate and from the embassy a full vita and dossier of Hosni Mubarak. And I was sort of taken by the parallels between Hosni Mubarak and Jimmy Afifi. So I asked also from the embassy, the Egyptian embassy in Washington, a resume and a vita on one Jimmy Afifi, or Jamal Afifi, an officer in the Egyptian Air Force. The embassy had no report, so they referred me again to the military attaché for a vita and report on the whereabouts of Jimmy Afifi. It took several days, but after several days, the Egyptian military attaché in Washington called me and said that there had never been a person in the Egyptian Air Command by the name of Jimmy Afifi. As far as they knew, there had never been anyone in the Egyptian Air Force by the name of Jamal Afifi. Now you say, well, what's all this story? Well, I suspect, and I'm not for sure, and I have not been able to verify it. When I approach the Israelis about this, I get nothing but a chuckle. Never mind. But what is amazing is that if you look at the parallel, first of all, Hosni Mubarak was born in Egypt on May the 24th, 1928, about the same age as Jamal Afifi, or the supposed Jamal Afifi. Hosni Mubarak graduated from the Egyptian War College in 1949 after he had already been a commander at El Arish. Isn't it strange that Afifi and Mubarak were both commanders at El Arish? There is no mention in his vita about his Mubarak about his experience in England. But immediately after Jimmy Afifi returned from the RAF school, he enters the Egyptian Air Command. Jimmy Afifi departed from the RAF school in December of 1950, and in 1951, January of 1951, we find that Hosni Mubarak is back in Egypt, and soon thereafter enters the Egyptian Air Command. From 1954 to 1956, according to the dossier on Hosni Mubarak, he was an instructor of the Egyptian Air Command Training School in Cairo. And on page 116 in Weitzman's book, he points out that during that time, that that Jimmy Afifi was also the instructor at the Egyptian Air Command. In 1959 to 1966, we find that Hosni Mubarak became the head instructor at the Egyptian Air Command. And in 1966, we find that he became the head air marshal of the Egyptian Air Command. Now, as the head air marshal of the Egyptian Air Command, he was the same position that is described by Mubarak as the director of the Egyptian Air Command. Simply another word where Ezra Weitzman used the word air marshal in the dossier by Hosni Mubarak, it's just the director of the Egyptian Air Command. And in 1967, according to
Weitzman. Jimmy Afifi was the deputy commander of the Egyptian Air Command, the same position that was held by Mubarak at that time. And then in 1969, Hosni Mubarak became the chief of staff of the Egyptian Air Command and occupied that until 1975. During the 1973 Yom Kippur War with Israel, Hosni Mubarak was the head commander of the Egyptian Air Force, supposedly the same position that was being held by Jimmy Afifi. In 1975, when Jimmy Afifi, or the friend of Ezra Weitzman, met him and delivered the planned assassination by the PLO of Sadat back to Egypt, at that very time, Hosni Mubarak was taken out as the chief of the staff of the Egyptian Air Command and made vice president of Egypt under Anwar Sadat. Isn't it strange that the coincidence of the time? And in 1977, when there was an attempt on his life by Gaddafi, at that time, Mr. Mubarak both came to Jerusalem in the peace negotiations. And in the Camp David meetings that followed, in November of 1978, in January of 1979, and in September of 1979, both Mubarak and Ezra Weitzman were together in Washington with regard to the development of the peace program that was being carried on by the supervision of Mr. Carter. Now, what is interesting about this, after the assassination of President Sadat, and I saw so many parallels between Mubarak and Jimmy Afifi, that when I made the request, there has never been any record of Jimmy Afifi. Now, it is my speculation, and I again say speculation, that there's a probability that Jimmy Afifi is the Clark Kent of the Superman Hosni Mubarak. And this Clark Kent Superman syndrome is simply applied by Ezra Weitzman in his book to cover and to protect the interests of his friend in Egypt. And like I say, this is totally hypothetical, but a lot of questions I think have been raised that need to be answered. And I say this in a constructive sense because it's a very beautiful situation when we step back and see the 19th chapter of Isaiah. And the prophet Isaiah said that they, after the sacrifice and oblation, he says, and they, the Egyptians, will perform it. And immediately after the assassination of Sadat, Hosni Mubarak, the new president of Egypt, said that Egypt would fulfill all of its signed agreements with Israel. Well, certainly you don't expect anybody to fulfill an unsigned agreement. Until it's signed, you have no agreement. So the beautiful thing about this peace relation between Israel and Egypt is that perhaps the two men now that hold the keys to the future of this are indeed the two architects to the Egyptian-Israeli peace. And perhaps today the chances of negotiations and a success of the peace program between Hosni Mubarak and Ezra Weitzman is much better than it was under the previous President Sadat and Mr. Begin, because we know that there were very strong personality conflicts. But here, if we have the two men that were the architects for this, we could see something very beautiful. Not only so, but it's very probable that following Menachem Begin as Prime Minister of Israel, Ezra Weitzman will very possibly and probably be the next Prime Minister of Israel. He has a combination of the old hawkish Ezra Weitzman that he was and the new Ezra Weitzman, and I think out of that will come a combination that he will have no trouble becoming the next Prime Minister of Israel. And if that is true, wouldn't it be a beautiful thought to see that this Jimmy Afifi, incognito Hosni Mubarak, who was a student with Ezra Weitzman back in 1950 in Egypt, and Ezra Weitzman, the nephew of Chaim Weizmann, might be the next Prime Minister of Israel, and we might see a relationship here between Israel and Egypt that has not existed since the days of the Ptolemies and the Hashmonaim in the second century before the Common Era. So this is just a thought that I wanted to share with you, the influence of the Bible, the influence of Isaiah chapter 19 in the Camp David meetings, and where we stand today after Camp David, after the assassination of Sadat, and at the threshold of the negotiations and the problem of the settlements and so forth that is discussed by Isaiah the prophet 25 centuries or 23 centuries before where we are. You know, the greatest thing and the thing that is most important in our study of the Bible and in the study of prophecy is not to try to prove that the Bible is true. We don't have to do that. But to see that dramatic fulfillment and infilling of the Word of God, as we see that God is still in control of the world today, and what is happening today is still directly under the leadership of God.